Welcome to The Debrief, everyone. We are here drastically early for those of you watching live on the Law and Crime Network today. We're glad you're with us. A delay in opening statements in the trial of a man accused of shooting and killing three men and then setting the scene on fire. Xavier Whitehead faces 8 counts over the November 2018 incident. Victims Derek Archie, Haley Stone, and Xavier Green all died. Co-defendant Ricky Wilkerson Jr. will testify against Whitehead under a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to being an accessory after the fact to murder and armed robbery. The judge, however, told the jury to take off for the day and to basically call and check in to see if the case could somehow get back on track.
Based on some legal issues that have arisen, we're not going to be able to proceed to trial at this time this morning. But rather than us be in here arguing about some of those issues and doing the legal things that we need to prepare for and do that are not appropriate for you, the jurors, to hear, I'm going to go ahead and let you go for a short time with the caveat that we may resolve the issues that we're dealing with now. Make sure that your client understands that I'm going to make a determination of competency. So if he chooses not to participate with Dr. Persini again, that's evidence the court can consider based on the totality of other evidence about whether or not he's competent to proceed at this time.
Attorney Stanley King and law professor Kirk Burkhalter are here today. So, gentlemen, this is all a competency hearing. What we're hearing from the courtroom as we speak is that apparently this defendant was involved in some kind of a fight or altercation behind bars and that he may have injured his head. So, Professor Burkhalter, take it from here. Why do we have to have this hearing, and why did we not just start things with opening statements this morning?
Well, as a matter of law, it's very important that the defendant is able to participate in his defense and understand the proceedings against him. If he cannot do so, can't proceed on with the trial. So the judge is doing the right thing, given the obviously the behavior of the defendant here. He's unresponsive to questions in previous proceeding, the getting into fights and so forth in prison. So it's very important that they do so they can continue on. On occasion, defendants sometimes may malinger, and you want to ensure that this is not the case.
Yes, Stanley King, we're hearing that this defendant is telling his attorneys he just wants to lay down and basically rest because of whatever happened. At least that's the accusation from the defense here. How do you think the judge should rule on this one? Should the judge push the proceeding forward, or should the judge just basically put a halt to this trial right here today?
No, the judge has to make certain that this defendant is capable to answer his defense. That is going to be an issue for an appeal if, in fact, this matter would proceed without giving this defendant an opportunity to aid in his defense. And I think the competency hearing is appropriate in this case.
And competency can be judged based on the standard of each individual day. So if in the middle of a trial, then, Attorney King, something happens to a defendant, that can cause a halt to the proceedings as well.
And oftentimes it actually does. Sometimes a judge will take a break if, in fact, someone needs to be hospitalized. This thing in real life happens all the time. You have to make certain that at the end of the day, the defendant gets his day in court, and there is nothing going to prejudice his opportunity to get a fair trial.
We're going to watch that hearing as it, sorry to interrupt you there, Stanley. We're going to watch that hearing as it continues throughout the afternoon here. Let's move on, though. Disturbing video to show you of a sheriff's deputy beating a man in custody. Several Ohio television stations are reporting that a Pike County deputy resigned because of what you're about to see here. The surveillance footage from November 18th shows former deputy Jeremy Mooney restraining a misdemeanor disorderly conduct suspect in a chair inside the sheriff's department. Then, for some reason, he takes the suspect outside to the parking lot of all places. The suspect pushed himself off the curb. You saw that. And then right there, the deputy returns, picks up what appears to be a can of pepper spray and sprays the suspect in the face, all while the suspect appears to be restrained in the chair. Then, after a few minutes, the suspect wheeled back inside, his face bloodied. A few minutes later, the officer punches him not once, not twice, but 3 times. Let's watch it again in slow motion right here. The local prosecutor has asked the FBI to step in and determine whether the deputy should face federal criminal charges. A supervisor who was present there has been demoted on that local force. So, okay, Stanley and Kirk, let's go back to you here. Kirk, I'm seeing a minimum of a federal civil rights lawsuit here against the police officer. Minimum, do you see anything else?
Well, like you said, that's the minimum. And not to mention, under state law, I would think that the police officer could be prosecuted for assault charges. You know, if there was an issue, we don't know if there's an issue with the arrest to begin with. However, this is just a heinous act. There's just no two ways about it. I think that the, you know, under the federal civil rights, the codification of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1871, which is a 1983 claim, this is about as clear as it gets when a law enforcement officer acting under the color of law abuses his authority and in so doing so abuses the civil rights of a person.
Exactly. I'm seeing the civil suit here. He asked the FBI to step in here, and I'm sitting here saying, Kirk, why did the prosecutor not use his own authority to push state charges here? Because he could do that.
It's somewhat odd. So we see this all the time where local prosecutors will bring actions against local law enforcement. So I don't know the nature, if this is a political issue or you know, what's going on. It seems like it's a smaller jurisdiction. But either way, the feds should step in here, clearly.
Spoken from the position of a law professor and a former member of a police force. Stanley King, didn't forget about you here. Hate to ask this question this way, but did this guy do anything to deserve this? Can the authority say, well, he pushed himself away from the curb, he was trying to get away, we needed to do something? I'm watching the video and I don't see that being plausible at all. Do you?
Obviously, that is not plausible. There isn't anything you can say that would justify this officer's conduct. It's egregious, it was uncalled for. The defendant, potential defendant, is going to be, he was really restrained. This was a punitive act. It was obvious that when he applied his pepper spray, it was uncalled for. He wasn't trying to restrain this person. As far as the punches in the face, there was no way this was this defendant offering any type of resistance. It wasn't done in any way to control this person or effectuate an arrest, and I don't see how this can be justified under any set of facts.
This is why we need the surveillance footage, gentlemen, of course. Other cases now. Attorneys weighing in about whether rap artist Tekashi 6ix9ine will be released from federal custody tomorrow here in New York. The rapper pleaded guilty to federal gang charges and agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. The government's sentencing recommendation says he is eligible for a 37-year sentence, but prosecutors note that he did eventually renounce gang affiliations and he testified against others. Tekashi 6ix9ine sent a letter to the judge who will sentence him saying he wants to use his position as an artist and role model to help others, but he also said he feared gang retaliation. An Iowa farmer acquitted in criminal court of killing his mother but found liable in civil court is countersuing his own father. As you saw here on Law and Crime earlier this year, a Marion County jury found Jason Carter not guilty of murdering his mother, Shirley. Carter had been sued by his father, Bill, and a civil jury awarded the father a $10 million judgment in 2018. An appeal of that judgment went nowhere, so now Jason Carter is actually countersuing his father for an unknown amount of damages and legal fees. Jason Carter claims law enforcement made false statements, lost evidence, and misled witnesses while investigating the mother's death. Father Bill Carter testified at Jason's criminal trial about the loss of his wife.
I found Shirley on the floor. And she was just looked like she was sleeping. Her eyes were closed. Her hands were crossed. And her legs were crossed. Jason came in. And I said, Jason, look how she's laying. You don't die that way. And then he said, Dad, go downstairs, see if a gun went off. The first thing I did was check her carotid artery. And she was dead. And then I picked her hand up and I kissed her on the forehead. And she was cold. And he said, some son of a bitch has robbed you and they've killed Mom.
Jason Carter, the son, even claims investigators learned their trade from watching TV shows. Those are one of the many new accusations. And still ahead tonight, here on The Debrief, the trial of a man accused of shooting an officer made famous by the hit show Live PD. That shot fired right in the officer's face. The jury has the case involving 10 counts against Ramon Bueno. We break down closing arguments and testimony from Trooper James Casey, the victim who survived. We're back with that case in just a moment. Welcome back, everyone. An Arizona jury resuming deliberations today in the case of a man accused of a series of crimes after prosecutors say he shot a Live PD state trooper in the face. Trooper James Casey survived that attack, which by process of elimination, Casey now believes was perpetrated by defendant Ramon Bueno. Bueno was in the back seat of a car Trooper Casey pulled over for having tinted windows. Three others were in the car. Casey testified that the occupants were behaving oddly, so he asked them for ID. One gave a fake name, and in the process of trying to figure that out, Casey said someone opened fire on him while he was trying to write down the troublesome occupant's social security number. During closing arguments, prosecutors say it's the defendant's own words during his police interview which show his guilt.
He says, my dumb wasn't there. And then Detective Butcher says, what's going to happen, Ramon, when your DNA comes back inside that vehicle? And he responds, and again, these are his words, not mine. I'm f***ed. He says, whether I was in that car or not, whether you're going to find DNA, I don't think you will. But then he says, if you're dumb enough to get caught, you're dumb enough to take the blame. Now it's really dawning on him. He's desperate, he says. But as far as guilty, innocent, or anything like that, my dumb f*** is caught. This is particularly chilling. 5129, when asked if he used any other names besides his nickname, he then, quote, says, why? What did you hear? And he smiles a big smile. He knows what this case is about. He completely changes his demeanor when asked about the nickname to that. Again, he's pretty smart. He says, I know a lot. And she said, likewise, Detective Butcher. And he responds, I know you do, but I don't mean to be this way, but it's my life. And if it's already over, it's my life. His life isn't over because he's lying or helping Danny or someone else. His life is over because he got caught.
Prosecutors also pointed to a video recorded from a railroad locomotive, which shows two men abandoning the car used in the shooting. Prosecutors suggest that Bueno is the one holding an object which could be a gun.
At 3:08:09. You're going to see the shadows of the men that Larry Martinez described to you. The defendant and Danny cross over in front. And remember this, the demeanor of how we described them, laughing and joking. Larry told you that the guy wearing the white shirt was bleeding from the lower left back. He had no idea when he was interviewed that someone had been shot, because remember, that was not broadcast over the news. And at 3:09:23, you're going to see the silhouette of a gun in the defendant's hand. The defendant did absolutely everything he could to get away with the attempted murder of Trooper Casey and the shooting of all three officers. As Casey started to die and choke to death on the pavement, Trooper Cruz worked to save Casey's life. Trooper Cruz, professionally and literally under fire, took control of the situation, saving his life and getting information out to first responders for the first 7 minutes.
The defense reminded the jury that Trooper Casey identified another passenger in that car named Danny Vargas as the attacker. The defense said the lead detective botched the case by relying on the car's driver, who has changed her story several times about who was sitting where.
She testified that Lori Richardson didn't waver that Ramon Bueno was seated behind her. She saved that for trial. She took an oath. She looked all of you in the eyes when she testified. And she put Danny Vargas behind her. You saw it, you heard it. That's one of Lori Richardson's many missteps that I'll address in a minute, but she saved it for you. Her testimony was pretty basic. There wasn't a whole lot she could goof up, but she did. You remember, Detective Butcher was on the witness stand, I said, can't the man who said, I hate cops, do this? Yeah. Yeah, he could. doesn't just have to be still. And if he does this, a trooper leaning against the outside of the car won't feel it. I didn't ask her if he could have lunged over and kicked on the door and dove over. I just said, couldn't he have done this? He's a big guy. Car's not that big. Or this. He's seated. Yeah, that's all possible. Again, there's no evidence in front of you about the trajectory of that bullet that struck Trooper Casey in the face.
The defense says no one can put a gun directly in the defendant's hands, and that the other man sitting in the back seat, Danny Vargas, said he hated cops, as you just heard, and other suspicious things.
Danny Vargas not only gave him a false name and acted as though he were sleeping, he told him, I hate cops. Trooper Casey said he kind of countered that by saying, I hate cops too, but that wasn't a funny exchange. Trooper Casey was probably trying to be disarming and just settle things down, but Danny Vargas wasn't. I hate cops. He's the one in the backseat passenger side who had his arms stretched out. I think that's how, relying on your collective memories, how Trooper Casey described it from the witness stand, and that's not suspicious. It should be. That's more suspicious than losing sight of someone's hand. And a juror question, one of 60 or 70 from all of you popped up. It was something like this. If you were not looking up, how do you know Ramon's the shooter? It's his instinct. It's his gut. It's what he thinks. It's what he hopes. It's what he believes. It's not what he saw. It can't be quantified. It can't be measured. It can't be examined. You find that the evidence has fallen short and is not proven guilty. What do you do? That's easy. Not guilty verdicts across the board. Remember the foreboding words of Danny Vargas and his behavior in the car. I hate cops.
On rebuttal, the prosecution went back to the forensics to try to determine who was sitting where and where the shots originated, and to try to convince the jury that Bueno was indeed the shooter.
The defense wants to pick apart each piece of the puzzle and say, look over here, it doesn't make sense. But when you put them all together, you have a very clear picture of what the defendant did. All of the evidence points squarely at the defendant. Now the defense wants to point the finger at Danny Vargas because he said, quote, I hate cops. Well, let me share with you something they say back in North Dakota. Birds of a feather flock together, there are no swans in the sewer. It is not a surprise that another Mexican mafia member has a similar outlook on life as the defendant. If Danny was the shooter, why was the defendant so concerned about Valeria snitching in his words? The defense can't decide if they like Lori Richardson or not. She's now testifying 5 years later, and you know memories fade. That is why law enforcement officers, they record their interviews, they write things down in reports, and you know that every single interview was recorded. They want her to be a liar and they want her to be telling the truth. But one thing she has said consistently, maybe not getting the names right, is it was the man seated behind her. And now we know that it was the defendant Ramon Bueno. And
Trooper Casey, of course, survived and took the stand. Now, it was unclear from his early testimony exactly where he was looking, when he was shot, or precisely who shot him. He tried to clear that up at the very end of direct examination.
He's sitting at the defense table. He's got a white shirt, a gray tie, and he's wearing glasses. The driver, she had her hands on the steering wheel, so her hands are accounted for. The front seat passenger, Vanessa Martinez, has her hands on both her legs like this. Both her hands are accounted for. Mr. Bueno has his left hand on his left leg. He has his right hand under a blanket. Valeria Jaime has a blanket, and she's wrapped up like this. I see both of the tops of her hands and her knuckles. Danny Vargas is laying on the window like this. Both of his hands are accounted for. As I've stated many a times after this, I got so focused on identifying that man over there, losing track of his right hand almost cost me my life. So I'm 100% sure he shot me.
Jurors allowed to ask questions in this trial. They wanted to know exactly where Trooper Casey was looking and why he took his eyes off of a group of people he testified were acting strangely.
The driver had her hands on the wheel. The passenger had her hands on her legs. Moan had one hand on his left leg. He had one hand under the blanket. Valeria had
both hands grabbing a blanket, holding it up. Danny Vargas was laying there. 9 out of 10 hands I can account for. The one hand I can't account for, it was his right hand, and that would be the one holding the gun, shooting. When I lost track of his hands was the second approach I was at. This is after I had Trooper Cruz Alfano with me now. So now we're, the first time was basically, I was getting everybody's information. My second approach, now we're in the investigative stage of it. So I was, at this point is where I lost track of his hands, because I said, like I said, I got so focused, it was a tactical error on my part. And as I said, it almost cost me my life. I got so focused on identifying him, trying to ID him, that I lost track of that right hand, and that hand went under the blanket. Every other hand I can account for. So, and a gun doesn't just fire on its own.
Okay, law professor Kirk Burkhalter and attorney Stanley King back with me now. So attorney King, I'm hearing from that trooper the words lost track and tactical error here. What I wanted him to say is exactly where his eyeballs were looking when the shot rang out. That's what I wanted to hear.
That's critical. And I listened to that testimony, and I'm thinking as a defense attorney now, that's a lot going on to say that you had your eyes on 9 hands and the one hand that you couldn't account for ultimately, caused a problem. The mere fact, I mean, he's very convincing in what he's saying, but I think that testimony, obviously, you have to really challenge that because there's a lot of things going on, and that is a critical piece of evidence that he's testifying to as to where this man's hand was and whether he actually saw a gun.
Exactly. You know, and he's also taken notes on the Social Security number. He's asking for a Social Security number, trying to write it down. So where are his eyes? Are they on his notes or are they on everyone's hands here? Kirk Burkhalter, the advocacy in this case, I think, has been excellent all the way around. It's been well tried. The judge has handled the case very, very well. The jury has deliberated 2.5 hours thus far, going down 10 charges. The jury's taking it seriously, going by the counts, presumably one by one. No quick verdict.
Well, it's interesting if the in particular, the prosecution's witnesses, I thought, were extremely credible here. The law enforcement officials gave very competent testimony. However, as far as the defense's case is concerned, there is no pardon upon smoking gun, meaning that there is no eyewitness that can identify that the defendant pulled the trigger.
Exactly. A lot of questions remain. Live coverage continues on the Law and Crime Network in a moment.